This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
Someone recently said to me, it's hard to know what helps people. And I would have to agree. In fact, it's almost impossible. Sometimes people will tell us, well, such and such would help me. And sometimes they're right. Sometimes they're quite wrong. Sometimes we may feel that we know what will help so-and-so. But and sometimes we're right. And sometimes the results are disastrous. And of course, partly that's rooted in the somewhat mysterious nature of what help means. I'm a fan of the TV show 30 Rock. Some of you probably watch 30 Rock. Really, it's extremely funny, most of the time anyway. And one episode, Tina Fey's gay nephew is in town. And he's very inexperienced, and he's wandering around New York by himself, so she's a little worried. So she has him call her periodically to say what he's up to. And he calls her up, and he says, she says, well, what are you doing? Oh, there's a guy who wants you to help him put a couch in his truck. No, dear, that's a serial killer. So don't do that. So, sometimes moving furniture is helpful for people. Other times it's not. Maybe those are the cases where it's obvious. And there are many, many more where it's not obvious. And we're told that really only the Buddhas know exactly what's helpful for someone at just the right moment. So I certainly claim no such knowledge. Still, there's some aspects of our life that are seem to cause us a lot of trouble. And maybe by chance, they are kind of sketched out by our version or understanding of the precepts. So kind of the areas where there can be considerable difficulty. Such things as violence, sexuality, honesty, how we relate to others, and how we take care of and deal with just even so-called inanimate objects in our lives, our possessions and so forth. These are all areas where trouble can arise. And one of the places that trouble can arise is, of course, in the lap of the Sangha, the Buddhist community. Any of you who have experience of Buddhist communities must have seen that. And if not, we'll just pick up one of the Buddhist periodicals and you'll read about troubles in the lap of the Sangha. So one of the general categories, though, of what seems to be helpful is for people to kind of look at and maybe study and experience what it might mean to meet other beings face to face in genuineness and openness, regardless of what's going on. That is one thing that I have found to be helpful almost universally. It's also helpful to me when I encounter beings that way. Did you want to move closer? No, you're all right? Okay. So, for instance, there's some, so far I think only gentlemen in the neighborhood who wander around naked. Have you seen them? They are bearing it all to the world. And when here I am, you know, wrapped up in multiple layers of clothing. My teacher once pointed out that layers are sort of reverse archaeological. Namely, the nearer they are to the skin, the newer they are. So I have like kind of have a wife beater t-shirt on, you know, which is kind of modern. And then on top of that, a old-fashioned Japanese kind of undershirt thing called the juban. And on top of that, an even older-fashioned, a Japanese robe, the kimono. And the kimono goes at least as far back as the Heian period in Japan, probably beyond that even. And has not changed much since then. And that's like, oh, you know, I don't know, 9th, 10th century, which is getting towards the end of the Tang Dynasty in China, for which we have to thank the next layer. So it's even older, the quasi-Confucian literati robe, the koromo on top. And then on top of that, the oldest layer of all, the Indian layer. The one shoulder, okesa, kashaya, as it's called in Sanskrit. So, oldest is outermost. And within all of these layers, there is a wheezy old body. But I want to say that the purpose of all of this layering is not, in fact, to hide. Although it can be used that way. It's actually to expose. Dressing this way actually exposes me or us. For instance, when we wear Buddha's robe in the large version like this or the smaller version around the neck, it's actually a kind of exposure. And an invitation to scrutiny. Now, some people don't know what it is, of course. And almost always, like if I visit a school or something, one or another of the children will say, "What's that thing you're wearing around your neck?" You know, I have to explain a little bit. And I usually don't, depending on their age, usually don't get to go into much detail about how this is a gesture of exposure. A little different from the guys who wander around naked in the Castro. But the idea is that our practice of encounter with other beings is kind of out there for criticism. And it's, you know, it's not so easy. If you are of a retiring nature, as I am, believe it or not, yes I am, entire nature, it's especially hard to appear in the world with an automatic invitation that people tell you about how you are in the world, you know, how you're doing. And in a sangha, at least a healthy one, that's definitely going to happen. In fact, that's one of the signs of a healthy sangha, depending on how it's happening. Because as we know perfectly well, you can beat someone to death with the truth if you want. And that's not very helpful. So I bring this up as a kind of footnote to some recent processes in our own sangha that I think, you know, we could have handled better. It was okay, no tragedies. But there were some instances where we weren't seeing each other and meeting each other in the way that I think is essential for practitioners to do. And in a way that is really difficult, challenging, and presupposes an uncomfortable degree of vulnerability. So this is not easy stuff, and I am under no illusions on that score. I'm also under no illusions on what happens if that work is not done. How quickly the atmosphere stagnates and eventually turns poisonous. And not only, of course, in Buddhist sanghas does this happen. It can happen in offices and families and you name it. Any place people get together. To paraphrase something or other, wherever two or more of you are gathered in my name. I don't know if Jesus actually said that, but I think some people say he did. I would say wherever that happens, there's trouble. Mm-hmm. And there is work to be done. Personally, if he did say that, that's what I think he meant. So, although it's tempting and understandable to shy away from that work, it's a mistake. And more than once, I've volunteered, you know, to share my vulnerability with the Sangha as a kind of invitation to everyone to do likewise, and not just with me, but with one another. Because in this last instance, it turned out that, you know, there are some bad feelings going around, and I heard just some inklings about it. And then there was a kind of a nasty confrontation between a couple of people, and I was a little puzzled by it. I thought, why? I couldn't figure out why this was happening. And it turned out there was an actual chain of causation going back some ways that I had not heard about. And along that chain were occasions where parties involved could have turned to one another and said, I have a little problem with what you did or what I think you did or what you said to me or whatever it is. And that would have grounded that painful, disruptive, destructive energy. And for some reason, that didn't happen. And, well, I think I know, because I also feel a temptation of, maybe I just won't get into this right now. Sometimes I need to, like, back away from a situation that feels very electric, and so much so that in my own karmic unfolding, the mind is kind of a little jangled, and I don't even know what to say. So it's like, okay, I gotta come back to this. But I usually try to tell a person, my vow is to come back to this. I just can't seem to talk about it right now. So could we stop for a little while and then come back? But for many of us, the temptation is not to go back at all. Okay, that was bad. I'm not going back there, ever. And then, you know, things get weird. The areas where people cannot meet grow and grow and grow until the sangha is barely functioning as such anymore. So, as I was pondering this, the power of cause and effect, and admiring our putative founder Dogen for urging us to have deep faith in that process of so-called cause and effect, I was remembering one of the stories from the record of transmitting the light, which is one of those great collections of quirky Zen tales. This one assembled by Keizan Senji, sometimes regarded as the second, sometimes regarded as the mother of Soto Zen in Japan, whereas Dogen's usually regarded as daddy. Keizan's often regarded as mommy. And so mommy wrote this very nice book, a collection of lectures that he gave. And in that telling of the tale, the 16th Indian ancestor was named Rahulata. And for that matter, it could have been Rahulata, which would make it a she. And really, I don't think we know how many of those ancestors from their names. We don't really know how many were women, but some surely were. So we could say Rahulata was a gal and a holder of the lineage of her ancestors. And when she met her, who was to be her heir, Sanghanandi, now he probably was a guy, because if it were a gal, it would be Sanghanandini, which it isn't. But anyway, let's say Rahulata was a gal and Sanghanandi was a guy. And when they encountered each other, after some rather fantastical events involving Sanghanandi being in samadhi for 21 days, and the only way they could tell that he was alive was that he didn't get pale like a corpse. So, I don't know about that stuff. But anyway, Rahulata, his ancestor, and some of her students were hanging around waiting for Sanghanandi to come out of this samadhi. And then they had this long, rather tedious conversation about what samadhi is. It's like, okay. But then Rahulata comes up with this very, very interesting poem. And she says, because I have no self, you should see myself. Because you see me as teacher, you should know I am not myself. I think that probably looks really good in Chinese. Personally, I can't visualize it, but I'd love to see it. And of course, it's much shorter in Chinese. Chinese gets a lot of mileage out of relatively few ideographs. There's a way in which this poem speaks, I think, quite powerfully to what we're talking about now. Namely, we say, you know, there isn't a permanent self to be found. No one in the history of humankind has found one yet. As far as I know, my teacher is still offering a reward of $10,000 to the first person to bring irrefutable evidence of the existence of a permanent self. So far, no takers. So I'm assuming it's not going to happen. Right? His money is safe, because, which is good, because I don't think he has $10,000. So we say there is no such self to be found. And ancestress Rahulata is pointing that out. But then she says, because that is so, you should see who's here. Because who is here is not a floating monad in the midst of a useless, uncaring universe, you should see what is here, namely me, which is something rather miraculous, something constantly evolving and manifesting, not on the basis of a isolated sovereign entity. In other words, you should confront this miracle, and I should confront yours. This is what she tells her heir-to-be. And she also says, if I should happen to be your teacher, you should know, don't forget, that miracle is not a self. So in this short, terse Chinese poem, somehow she manages to wrap up all of Buddha's teaching in a way that emits radiation that has reached, sort of like plutonium, to this very day. Its half-life is not yet exhausted, teaching us about the manifesting, evolving self and how we must see each other as such and not be taken in, not get into the ancient habit of converting that into a separate, unreachable being. So that was a pretty skillful teaching on her part, and one that I take to heart now. And when I try to, when I make the effort to meet beings in that fashion, well, it's a little, you know, it has a kind of eerie feeling, an exposed feeling, a vulnerable feeling. And yet, that expresses the heart of practice, I would say. And of course, you want to go into the next moment with that, you might wind up with the burden of another being's self, if you forget what's actually in front of you. At a talk here quite a while ago, vigorous practitioner, I forget what the exchange was, but was pointing at me, and I said, you know, it's kind of rude to point. And this person said, there's no self, there's nothing wrong with pointing. And I said, because there's no self, it's rude. That's why. If there were a self, who cares? Because there's no self, care must be taken. Because there's no self, we should see the self, the person who is there. So interestingly, none of the people involved in this thing I'm talking about are here. Figures. But anyway, that's the way it goes. Maybe they'll listen to the tape, I doubt it. But anyway, nonetheless, I want to extend this invitation and promise to the Sangha that I will keep trying to practice that way, even though when the conversations get tight like that, I want to shrink away too. You know, it's like, oh, I don't want to do this. And yet, I realize that is not helpful. Again, it's okay to do that and then maybe come back. But to just stay away and away and away is not helpful. So, I hope you'll join me in this difficult practice. And if for some of you it evolves into joining the naked gents wandering around Castro, I'll try to support you in that. although it isn't exactly the weather for it anymore. But maybe, you know, let's join together in a shared understanding that donning these weird clothes is about exposure and not about hiding. And then let the chips fall as they may. I admire my teacher because he kind of likes this stuff, you know, when he like gets into sticky things with people. He's kind of up for that. And that kind of made him a good abbot, I think, for a while. And so I try to follow his example. It's like, okay, I'm not really up for it, but in any case, my vow is to show up for it when it's needful. And this, of course, is in the spirit of the Bodhisattva precepts. The spirit of showing up in these strange, shifting realms where it's not always clear what's helpful to people. And yet, let's try to find each other as the self that's not there in the midst of actual circumstances. See what happens. Perhaps you have some comments or questions. Yeah, then.
It is a very painful practice to watch other people's karma take them, you know, just push them so strongly.
Yeah.
You know, and there is that wanting to help.
Yeah.
And so you were very helpful through this last thing.
I hope so.
With, you know, just you know, reality check from time to time, right? And it was very helpful. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you can't really interfere with. It's more like creating space, and it is a practice.
It is a practice.
And it's a hard practice. And yeah. I think if we solve that here, we help solve it in the world.
Yeah, I agree. Even though not everybody's up for it, and you can tell pretty quick. You encounter
maybe
someone.
They don't have the experience.
They don't have the experience, and right off the bat, it's often scary.
Yeah.
And it seems better to.
Just, you know, emotions,
excuse me, I've got something on the stove. I gotta see around. But hopefully, they'll also have the experience of turning into that difficult space and feeling something expand or open. Especially if they're not met by violence, which is sometimes, you know. I've had people invite me into such conversations and then proceed to the attack. That's really hard to stay still for.
It's, like, it's tension. It's mm-hmm. It's just like something at the core.
Yeah.
It's like a nuclear reactor.
Yes.
We were talking about plutonium before. And
yes.
Like, whoa. It's not even what they're saying. It's just more that.
Right.
Projectile stuff.
Yes. Projectile vomiting of a sort is coming at you. And if you can, you know, kind of hang out there.
Or sometimes go. Be back in a little bit,
yeah.
Hold that thought.
I need a drink of water, I'll come right back.
And then
yeah.
When that core thing relaxes a
yeah.
little bit, then it's like engaged.
Other possibilities happen, yes, right, exactly. So I'm, you know, I'm a little bit of a coward, so I sometimes tend to like skitter away and then come back. So, some of you others have experience or would like to? Yes.
Yes, I was, you know, agree with what Jim was saying about it. It was difficult to watch other people's karma, you know, take it to bad places. And I think that one of the reasons it's so difficult is because it's not just their karma. You know, you are involved in it if
right.
you've gotten that far in the interaction. And, you know, so Saganandi's poem.
Rahulata's poem.
What's that? Rahulata's poem.
Mm-hmm.
I had the, you know, it's an encapsulation of the teaching. And, you know, I've heard it said that teaching is only actually communicated in flames.
Mm-hmm.
So I worked with a psychiatrist who's Okay, I mean, she was fairly, established in her career when I was a medical student, so she's, you know, fairly senior and experienced. And I was complaining to her how hard it is to calculate something rational for people who are just, you know, totally chaotic and have, you know, are delusional and psychotic. And she was, you know, trying to sympathize and provide advice, and I wasn't, you know, really able to deal with it. And finally she said, look, Larry, as long as I'm practicing with people who are psychotic, I know that I'm never going to be psychotic. And I said, no, I'm not so confident for myself. And she says, no. And I realized what she meant was that if you're really practicing with people who are psychotic, then you're constantly confronting your own craziness.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're aware of where that line is, and you're probably not going to cross it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not this convenient situation where you're sure that I understand their craziness because I'm not crazy.
Mm-hmm.
That never happens.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, I just want to, you know, be happy and on vacation all the time. And she said, yeah, so do I.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so do I, come to think of it. I have not managed that yet. Yeah. Well, I have a feeling that most beings at some point in their lives visit crazy at some point, even if only for a few minutes, and then are able to return to something less crazy. And some just stay there for whatever karmic reasons. And often what they say is helpful to them is not very convincing. So then, what do? Well, we turn to people such as yourself, who are in the line of fire. And sometimes some of those people come here, actually. One gentleman who's pretty severely alcoholic and comes and camps on our doorstep from time to time and is can be quite belligerent. He was here again yesterday. And fortunately, I was not in a belligerent frame of mind yesterday. So this time, he's lying on the walk out there, literally lying on the walk, even though the sun was down, it was very cold. And he had his transistor radio, which was playing like Fox News or something really awful, you know, kind of listening to it. And told him that I was trying to talk to some people in here and the radio was kind of loud. Could he turn it down? And he was talking back to me, but in no way that I could understand. It was completely incomprehensible. And so I just said, well, how about turn down the radio? You know, and he babbled back at me. And then he finally stood up and I said, thank you. And he said, thank you, and walked away. So I thought, I had no idea what was helpful in that situation, although it was probably helpful not to be tempted into belligerence with him, where I have unfortunately visited before. And he was in a particularly bad way yesterday, unable to communicate at all. And again, I didn't exactly know what to do except to say, well, see myself here, kind of asking you to not play your radio. And maybe he did. And I was also attempting the what my brother calls the ministry of presence, is to be with the person and see his self without believing that that was a private, ultimate entity right there. And maybe there was, as a result, enough flex in the situation that neither of us got belligerent, and he just wandered off to his next venue. So things don't always turn out so neatly. And yet the effort that we bring to the situation, the effort to see who's there and be seen without stumbling into wrong view, is kind of our practice. And it's supported by Zazen and supports Zazen in turn. Any other questions or comments?
I just moved by the Dharma talk. Reminds me of what the meditations I'm reading now by Thich Nhat Hanh on love, and saying that, and paraphrasing, because I can't remember exactly what the Buddha said, but an angry person approached him and he smiled. Buddha smiled and saying, the example was, is that anger cannot arise in one that doesn't have the anger.
Mm-hmm.
So and the guy just, man, why are you smiling? You know, here I am so angry with you. So, I think it was something his nephew joined, his rich nephew or something joined the Sangha, and he was upset with that.
Mm-hmm.
And so Thich Nhat Hanh goes on and says to have empathy for others who are suffering. It's important to first empathy with ourselves. The meditation is to identify my own anger and recognize the sources of my anger, delusions, and cravings. So it's, it kind of goes back as like to see my own suffering,
mm-hmm.
Then I can see also the suffering of others,
right.
In a moment.
Right. Yeah, we've talked before about the practice of compassion being willing to be touched by others' suffering, and how that you kind of have to be willing to touch your own suffering. Otherwise, something, it remains kind of artificial somehow. Mm-hmm. You have to be willing to be forgiving of and gentle with ourselves in order for that to manifest with others. And that's very difficult sometimes, especially if you're inclined to be harsh with oneself, as I kind of am, courtesy of a Catholic upbringing. Fortunately, many hours and thousands of dollars spent in therapy has kind of taken the edge off that, not to mention a lot of Zazen. So, there is hope. Well, we have lots to eat today. Brother Craig over there made us a lovely apricot.
It's an apricot streusel bar.
It looks delicious. So we got homemade stuff and all kinds of things. And I hope you will join us. There aren't too many announcements, except remember that our yearly retreat is coming up. First week of December, the so-called Winter Light Retreat, which will start on Wednesday the something and end on Sunday the something by noon. So it's like about 3-4 days, like the sixth, I think that's right, Wednesday the sixth, evening, Wednesday the sixth, and then in 7, 8, 9, 10. At lunchtime on the 10th, Sunday the 10th, and you can sign up. Fourth, fifth, sixth. Okay. I think that's right.
Maybe it's the
seventh.
I don't know.
I think it's the sixth.
Somewhere around in there.
Because there's one day. There's one day.
It's Wednesday to Sunday.
And then eighth. The eighth is the enlightenment day.
Yeah.
And I think that's the Friday. And then so anyway. Sign up. You can sign up for the whole thing, or you can drop in and out. It's one of our specialties around here. Drop in Zazen. We love that. So we'll have the schedule on the doors, and you can come in as you see fit. Preferably when there's a break or a walking meditation. But if not, then come in very quietly. But if you want to eat with us, you have to sign up, because otherwise we won't be able to figure out how much food to make. Yeah.
And there's a Dharma talk.
Each
day,
yeah. At probably we'll keep the same thing, like 10:15. Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much.